Today on Wings, the second and final part of a speech delivered in California by Dr. Vandana Shiva, a very influential scientist, policy analyst, and activist from India. In last week's episode, Dr. Shiva deconstructed the rhetoric of genetically modified agriculture. This week, she speaks more to solutions.
There is at this point a huge parting of ways, two paths for the human future. One is no future at all, and the other a future in peace with all of the earth and all her species. We'll have to be more brilliant than we've ever been, more resilient than we've ever been, more courageous than we've ever been.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The single biggest threat to our health is what is called food but is not food. Because you can cheat on a supermarket shelf, but you can't cheat the cells of the body. An artificial molecule will be recognized and show up in disease. Poisons will show up in disease. I think one of the big debates that's going to grow is the fact that most of the GMO crops cultivated are Roundup ready, which means the use of glyphosate. And the combination of glyphosate and GMOs is triggering so much harm to the planet as well as our health. A lot of it is not allowed to come out. But the science is growing. How much can you hide? The science is growing about glyphosate not being a safe chemical. There's a movement of moms across America. There's also a counter-movement of Moms for Monsanto, by the way, to deal with Moms Across America. Moms Across America collected their own breast milk samples, and some of the women had 10,000% more than the permissible limit. Food is the place where we really become part of the Earth family. Food and air, the oxygen we breathe that's given by the trees, and food as the currency of the web of life. As an ancient text, an Upanishad says, everything is food, everything is something else's food. Food is the web of life. And when you realize that everything is food and everything is something else's food, we wouldn't do pyramids with man at the top because there'd be microorganisms above us. And they have a feast when we go. In India, we cremate, but where you bury. We are not the last link in the food chain. Who said that? We're just a link in the food chain. And the food web of life is where we can, on the one hand, be the most destructive species on the planet or start serving the earth and respecting the rights of nature. We are on a road to extinction if we carry on the path that we've been walking. We might as well be writing our RIPs right now. There is at this point a huge parting of ways, two paths for the human future. One is no future at all, and the other a future in peace with all of the earth and all her species. There is a survival struggle, but not in the Darwinian style. The survival struggle right now is about corporate rule trying to survive at any cost. And issues like the ruling of Citizen United is one example, where corporate influence on democracy is translated into free speech. As was commented when the decision came out, even though corporations are artificial entities with greater access to capital, infinite longevity, and no interest in or connection to humanity, I would add no connection to nature either, we now guarantee them the right of free speech. Freedom of speech was intended as a way for human beings to guarantee their ability to speak out against largely systemic and structural repression. A corporation has the same guarantee. And if the corporation has that guarantee, then people don't. And we've seen two very clear expressions of the perversion of the idea of corporate personhood. It is a perversion. One is the fact that after having used money to destroy democracy in the area of labeling of GMO foods in California, in Washington, in spite of that, Vermont got its GMO labeling law through. So what is the response? The response is the corporations get together and say, if you know what you're eating and you have the choice to make whether you'll eat organic or GMO, then you are taking away our free speech. That's what it means, suing Vermont on the grounds of free speech, on an issue of labeling, which is a right to know, basically saying citizens' freedom have to be extinguished in order to establish corporate freedom to destroy democracy, destroy the planet, and destroy our health. And that clearly cannot be accepted. The other place where this corporate personhood is being attempted to be institutionalized is in this new generation of free trade treaties. Now, you know, they put in place World Trade Organization as the ultimate free trade treaty, and they called it the Constitution of the World. And then we organize in Seattle, we organize in Bangalore, we organize in Cancun, and WTO has been in intensive care. It's no more a very efficient vehicle because everyone knows what that treaty is. So they're trying the same trick through the transatlantic and trans-Pacific partnerships on trade. And when we organized for Seattle and shut WTO down, The Economist was writing cover stories against us. The same Economist now is writing on the fact that these new trade treaties have these sections which are called investor-state dispute mechanisms, which basically means corporations can sue governments that pass laws to protect their citizens, whether they be environmental laws or health laws or workers' rights laws. And I was very interested to see that even the Economist has to say this corporate personhood is going too far. This is what the Economist says. If you wanted to convince the public that international trade agreements are a way to let multinational companies get rich at the expense of ordinary people, this is what you would do. Give foreign firms a special right to apply to a secretive tribunal of highly paid corporate lawyers for compensation whenever a government passes a law to, say, discourage smoking, protect the environment, or prevent a nuclear catastrophe. Yet that's exactly what has happened in these texts that are being prepared. Now, there are two recent examples of how this was used. After the Fukushima disaster, the green movement in Germany was able to mobilize. The Greens won elections in some regions, and they were able to call for a ban on nuclear power. But soon after the decision to shut down nuclear power plants, Germany was sued by a Swedish company called Vattenfall, which demanded compensation of $4.7 billion, saying, we have lost our market, and you compensate us. When Bolivia stopped the water privatization, Bechtel sued Bolivia. Indigenous people of Ecuador won a very important case, and I realize there's been recent public tribunals on the issue of a Chevron leak out here. Well, Chevron was responsible for destroying large parts of the Amazon, and indigenous people filed a case, and they won. But Chevron is now suing the government of Ecuador. Because the people of Ecuador won against Chevron, Chevron is suing the government of Ecuador for compensation for the losses. Our call in Seattle was, our world is not for sale. And I think between the time of Seattle and today, the evolution in movements has been, at that point, what we said was, our world is not for sale. Now we're saying we are part of the earth. We will respect the rights of Mother Earth. Therefore, we will have all human rights which are derived from nature and her ability to give us the food and water and the clean air, that human rights and nature's rights now require that all violations of the rights of Mother Earth and the rights of people be treated as ecological and human rights violations and crimes. We're not going to go there just by saying it. We'll have to be more brilliant than we've ever been, more resilient than we've ever been, more courageous than we've ever been. And we have that capacity. I've been saving seeds and dealing with laws that take away farmers' rights. We've been dealing with creating alternatives, particularly in areas where seed monopolies, like in the case of BT Cotton, have pushed a huge number of Indian farmers to suicide. Government statistics, it's 291,000. These are not my figures. I'm not cooking up figures. These are official statistics. And official statistics are an underestimate. They're an underestimate because if you've leased land and you're not a landowner, that doesn't count as a farmer's suicide. It's put into the box of ordinary suicide. So there's an undercounting. One would say there's a much higher number. But the seed issue has taken a whole new level. In 2004, we had an attempt to pass a seed law that would make local seed saving illegal. I traveled the country. Wherever I knew people, we held rallies, we collected signatures, and we collected 100,000 signatures, which I gave to our prime minister with our pledge, which said, when the British tried to control the salt through a salt monopoly and a salt law, Gandhi went to the beach, picked up the salt, said, nature gives it for free. We need it for our survival. We will continue to make salt. We will not obey your law. And the salt law could never be implemented. Gandhi was put into jail, but the law could never be implemented. We continue to make salt. And we told our prime minister, we've received these seeds from nature and our ancestors. We owe it to future generations to hand this over in full integrity, diversity, and freedom. We will not obey any law that prevents us from performing this ecological duty to the earth and to future generations. We managed to stop that law. But it's interesting that in the same year, 2004, your country got a seed law, and nobody knows about it. Now they're using the 2004 law to go after citizens who are saving a few seeds in seed libraries. First they go after citizens, then they'll go after the seed businesses, then they'll go after wherever there's freedom. It's time for a satyagraha in the United States. And for those who don't know what a satyagraha means, satya means truth, agraha means force, the force of truth. This was Gandhi's word for not cooperating with unjust law. He first put it to use against apartheid in 1906. Said, we will not be divided by race. We are one humanity. And we will not obey your laws on racial separation. Apartheid means separation. Ecological apartheid means separation in our minds from the earth and all she gives us. Gandhi then used the same satyagraha for salt, used it against the forced cultivation of indigo. We need a global satyagraha, a global satyagraha for the rights of nature. We need a global satyagraha that, as always, as every satyagraha does, arises from the deepest love, both of our relationships with nature and our relationships with community, as well as a deep respect for who we really are, because what we are is Earth citizens. What we are is part of one common humanity. And the same process of globalization that is creating the rule of fictitious beings who aren't beings is also dividing people. All of what's going on in the Middle East, the conversion of what began as an Arab Spring into an Arab nightmare, is linked to these issues. It's linked to the fact that the movement in Egypt began with bread. The movement in Syria began on drought. Farmers were suffering a very severe drought, so they marched to the capital. They were thrown into jail. Others came to support their relatives and friends. Before you know it, they were being called rebels. Before you know it, there was a war. Before you know it, an anti-Assad rebellion was suddenly ISIS. And now we don't know anymore who's an enemy and why they're there and why they're doing what they're doing. But we do know this, as Gandhi said, the earth has enough for everyone's needs, but not for a few people's greed. We have a very beautiful prayer that talks about peace in a deep sense. It talks about peace with the earth, talks about peace with the skies, it talks about peace with the waters, about peace with the plants, peace with space, and says, may that peace be with you. And I read peace with the waters as the ability of rivers to flow free and unpolluted. I see the peace with the plants as plants being able to evolve into the future without being genetically engineered and contaminated with toxins and without being patented. And peace with the sky is quite clearly the call to say, stop messing up the atmosphere. Now, we have solutions in our hands, because while industrial farming is the single biggest contributor to climate change, ecological agriculture is the single biggest solution that we have to deal with emissions. And while some of us go to climate treaties and some of us go to our capitals, most of us can make the change where we are. And the beauty of multiple crises being connected is multiple solutions are also connected. It's the same actions that we need to take. That is, working in harmony with the earth. When we respect nature's rights, nature produces more food with us. All we have to be is co-creators and co-producers. When we respect nature's rights, we conserve biodiversity, and that biodiversity works for us. The pollinators, now they're counting, $169 billion annually is the contribution to our food economy, and yet we are killing them. You allow them to thrive, we have more food. The more organic matter we have more water. If California's soils had been organically farmed, the drought of this year would not be as severe as it is. So while the crisis is deep and extinction stares us in the face, the earth is inviting us to change our path, to create an earth democracy, to shape an ecological age with humility with respect to the earth, but brilliance in all our hearts and all our minds, because I do believe brilliance also lies in the heart. The rights of Mother Earth, the rights of the humanity are not separable. And the most radical power we can generate against this abusive corporate rule and its fictions of corporate personhood is celebrate our own being and celebrate all the beings that give us life. We couldn't have a more exciting moment to be alive in. Thank you.
On Wings, you're listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, speaking in Berkeley, California, at an event organized by KPFA Community Radio in October 2014. Now, excerpts from questions and answers. Some questions are rephrased by the editor, Kelly Ramirez Watson.
Most of the movements in southern countries, which were called underdeveloped, developing, have been based on the rights of nature and humans as a subsystem of this planet and nature. The first movement I got involved in 40 years ago was CHIPCO, where women came out and hugged trees. And it was based on the rights of the forest and the rights of mother goddesses of the forest, but it was also based on what the forest provided and the rights of the women to those products. But it wasn't only about human rights, it was also about the rights of nature. Four southern cultures which have had a continuity in their ecological existence as ecological societies, rights of nature has been the ground for all human rights work. Every anti-dam movement has been about the rights of the river to be able to flow free. From industrialized cultures, the rights of nature movement is now emerging. Through the solidarity with countries like Ecuador, which actually put this in its constitution and unfortunately is not adhering to the constitution so respectfully, or the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth, made after the Copenhagen negotiations were subverted by, sadly, President Obama flying out from his Peace Prize, going and telling India, China, Brazil, South Africa, why obey these international treaties? Let's just have a consensus amongst ourselves and get rid of legally binding treaties. And that's when Evo Morales took the initiative, the drafting of the Rights of Mother Earth, which is a very powerful document. I think there are two other places where this is happening, which is at the level of communities realizing that as human communities, we are stronger when we ally ourselves with the rights of nature. not in an instrumental way, but at a level of higher consciousness, as when you raise your consciousness to be part of a bigger web of life, you yourself expand in your capacity. You expand in your courage. And every movement that has been inspired by the rights of nature is a stronger movement. It's a stronger movement that shifts the ground from begging for favors, from structures of power, to declaring solidarity and protection with all beings. And I know here in this country around fracking, you have so many initiatives. In Italy, local communities love the word territory. They talk about territory as the place where you belong, the unique ecosystem, its plants, soil. And they are declaring in more and more municipal councils sovereignty for their territory, which means no poisons, no pesticides, no GMOs.
Dr. Shiva was asked what she would tell the audience to do.
Well, I never tell anyone else what to do. I ask myself what I should be doing. And I do invite people to both see the amazing threats to our biodiversity, our climate, our food systems, but also the amazing opportunities that are in our hands, if only we would wake up to them. Not underestimating the small, because it's millions of small that'll make the big movement of our times. Not one big movement where all of us march with one slogan. There will be no one slogan beyond the fact of the rights of Mother Earth. And it's not going to be our slogan. It's going to be her slogan. All we have to do is follow the instructions and work in compassion and solidarity in a deep, deep way, realizing none of us are in a situation where we can say, oh, it's their problem, this won't hit me. Everyone will be affected. Everyone is being affected. The privileged can insulate themselves for a little time longer, but it's just for a little time longer. I think the two big things everyone can do is see ourselves as part of an interconnected world. That alone, that shift in consciousness, is a very powerful step. We've always thought doing is physical action, but doing is also mental shifts. It's a doing within. And that doing leads to a lot of external possibilities. The second is we need to give up the primacy to our silos. It's been secure. I'll protect fish. But you know, the fish is linked to how much runoff there is from the farms. So you can't just say, I love fish. You've got to say, I don't like violence to animals. I'm not going to support chemical farming. So the connections keep growing. And as we see these connections, we develop respect for each other's work. And we develop respect for each other's space. This body is 500 trillion cells. 500 trillion cells can cooperate. Why can't some of us?
Dr. Shiva was asked if technology itself was evil, or could it be used beneficially?
I would not talk about technology in terms of evil or good. Technology is a tool, and a tool gets assessed for its usefulness. So I think some technologies are absolutely useless, GMOs being one candidate. We don't need them. They don't do any work for us. They don't control pests. They don't control weeds. They don't increase nutrition. They don't increase food. So as a tool, we know that we are better off with biodiversity, with intelligence of human beings, to breed crops, to grow ecological food, to increase productivity through co-creation with other species. That's how we control pests, control weeds. That's how we increase nutrition. And some technologies are intrinsically hazardous. The big debate on GMOs is, you know, if this was in a public system, it would be fine. But a BT toxin is a BT toxin. With Monsanto, it has a patent associated with it. But even without that patent from a public university, that toxin is a toxin that harms the butterflies and bees, that survives in the blood of women and in the embryos. That toxicity doesn't go away according to the political context of which it is a part. So that's why we need technology assessment. We have created a utopia of stupidity around technology use. We need to use other values to judge. Is a technology delivering or not delivering? And the three big values are, what does it do to nature and ecosystems? What does it do to our health, and what does it do to our freedom? Those are the tests of democracy, safety, and ecological sustainability that every technology must be passed through. And on GMOs, that's what we keep saying. Let it pass the test. It's continued to fail, but let it pass the test. And what the industry is afraid of is the test.
She was also asked what farmers and consumers in the United States and the rest of the world can learn from India's experience in fighting GMO producers such as Monsanto and Syngenta.
The first is to realize that it's happening here too. Farmers might not be committing suicide on that scale, but farmers are committing suicide in this country. I read a book called Harvest of Rage soon after I'd written The Violence of the Green Revolution. And I realized that in India, farmers first took to guns and violence and then moved to suicide when the military oppression came. In this country, they first committed suicide. So the crisis is here. In terms of the seed issue, I do feel that these first few beginnings of serving notice to seed libraries should be of citizen concern, not just to the few people who were trying to create the seed library. I think that law of 2004 needs to be studied. We've written a law of the seed, group of scientists, group of lawyers, to basically understand from the seed, how does seed really evolve? And therefore, any law that's based on rights of nature should follow that law. Seed does not evolve into a monoculture. Even within the same variety, it has a little diversity. Even within the same family, children will be different. So diversity is the nature of evolutionary freedom. The second quality of seed that evolves in freedom and societies and cultures that evolve in freedom is resilience. But what's being imposed through these laws that are making seed saving illegal, and in fact, the statement has been made that saving seeds that has been used over thousands of years, is agri-terrorism. How can planting an ancient heirloom tomato be agri-terrorism? You need to have the safety of GMO crops. So this new vocabulary that's being created around uniformity, terrorism, etc., needs to be contained now. And it can only be contained, as I said, through the Satyagraha.
You've been listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, renowned scientist, feminist, and activist from India, speaking in Berkeley, California, at an event organized by KPFA Community Radio in October 2014. For more information on the movements Dr. Shiva works with, visit the website www.navdanya.org. Navdanya is spelled NavdanyA. That's navdanya.org. Dr. Shiva's speech was edited for Wings by Kelia Ramirez Watson. This is the second of two parts. If you've missed any Wings program, email wings@wings.org or check our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm the Wings series producer, Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.